My name's Michelle Owu. I'm carrying out this interview on behalf of the Wellcome Trust. The object of the research is to compile a portrait of the UK as it is now. The date is the 25th of July 2009, and the time is 5:19 a.m. Can you please tell me your name, your age, and where you come from?
I'm Simon Sweetman. I'm 65, and I come from Felixstowe, Suffolk, these days.
Did you come up from Felixstowe?
No, I've been staying overnight in Finsbury Park with my brother.
How did you hear about the project? Can you remember?
Well, originally, in fact, it was my wife rather than me who heard about it, and we both put our names forward, and of course it was me that got picked and not her. So she was a bit miffed to start with, but I think she wouldn't actually been all that keen on standing up there when it came to it.
But did you say she suggested
that? But it was her idea in the first place, yes. I mean, we both like Anthony Gormley's work anyway.
So why did you agree to take part and apply?
Well, because when she suggested it, it did seem like a nice idea.
What appealed to you about it?
I think it was the idea of using it to fill the plinth. I mean, I do sort of take buses fairly frequently that go through Trafalgar Square, you know, and you notice that the generals and things standing on their plinths. It seems a nice thought to have something completely different, have ordinary people standing up there and doing their thing.
What are you going to do with your hour on
the plinth? I'm going to be doing my life in T-shirts. I knew I had quite a few, and then when I actually sort of started unpacking, and they came to about 50, I've obviously cut down from that. But T-shirts, politics, music, sport, you know, so quite an assortment, I hope.
What's the earliest T-shirt you brought along with you?
I would think some of them are about 30 years old, probably. I've certainly, one of them is a Support the Liverpool Dockers T-shirt, and that was in the early 80s.
Why was that something which was close to your heart?
It was just at that time, you know, I was generally involved in radical causes then. I was at one point the chair of East Anglia CND, you know, so and in fact, at that time, yes, because my youngest daughter, we reckoned, had been on 13 demos by the time she was a year old.
What was it like going on some of those early demos?
Well, there were a lot of people then. This was the 80s, and it was a popular cause again. You know, it wasn't like it was for, there were people who went going through the 70s, and the numbers got very small. I remember actually once going to try and join the Aldermaston March in the 1970s, and it was so small we couldn't find it. But, you know, by the 80s there were big demos. There'd be 250,000 people down for some of them in London, and we also did local ones. I remember one where we walked from from Ipswich to Woodbridge Air Force Base, and we had the youngest in the pram at that stage, and there was a very helpful the wheel started to come off the pram, and we had a very helpful policewoman who walked beside us all the way holding the wheel on.
You mentioned that you were chairman of regional CND, is that right?
That's right, yes.
How did you become involved in that? How did that come about?
I think it was just, you know, I was certainly in the Labour Party at that time, and this was the time of the cruise missiles, so people got reactivated, people got interested again.
Have you been on many demonstrations in Trafalgar Square?
Not many, because they haven't allowed Trafalgar Square for a long time. And also, of course, it wasn't big enough for the big demos. So I've been in demonstrations that went through Trafalgar Square, probably on the way to Hyde Park or something like that, but I've not actually been on one in Trafalgar Square, I don't think, though there were so many it's hard to remember.
How do you feel about being here now at this time of the morning?
Well, it was quite a struggle to actually sort of get myself together and come through. I mean, I don't think it's a bad time. It looks as if there are going to be more people about than I expected. And of course, you know, there are a lot of people who've told me they're going to be watching it on their computers. They may be lying to me, but that's what they say.
How did you feel when you heard you had a place on the plinth?
I was quite, I suppose the word's gobsmacked, really, because I really hadn't expected it. I had an email that told me. So I sort of rushed downstairs, told me Mrs. Yeah.
How would you describe yourself as a person, do you think?
Well, that's a difficult one, isn't it? I think my mainly these days, I think I'd call myself a family person. You know, we've got four grandchildren, and luckily, they only live a few miles away from us. They haven't got a car, so we see an awful lot of them, and they're coming down. Well, three of them are coming down. The youngest is only 4 months old. But three of them have come down today and should be there to watch.
What else is important to your life apart from the family and the grandchildren?
Well, I'm still working, though that's slightly easing off, really. I'm a self-employed tax consultant. And, in fact, what's happened to that is that I do stuff with the Federation of Small Businesses, and I've been talking to Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs over the years, trying to persuade them that inquiries into the tax position of small businesses wastes their time and money, that there really isn't that much to be gathered from there. They've now largely come round to that view, but a side effect of that is that I've lost a lot of the work I did, because I was, you know, usually representing those people. And then the other thing I do is I edit a journal called the Cricket Statistician, which is the journal of the Association of Cricket Statisticians and Historians, and that takes up a bit of time.
Can you tell me more about that role? What's involved?
Well, basically, it's collating the articles that people write, chasing people a bit to write for it, putting it together. You know, sending it off to be typeset and whatnot.
What kind of subjects does it cover?
It's a mix of subjects, as I say, statistics and history. But one of the things, for instance, that we're doing now is a series called Lives in Cricket. Basically, not of tremendously well-known people, not of the sort of people who would have had their biographies written professionally or have had ghosted autobiographies or anything like that, but really people that individual members of the association feel some sort of connection with. I'm supposed to be working on one, well, I am working on one, about a guy called Hesketh Pritchard, who played cricket before the First World War. But he didn't just play cricket. He was a writer. He wrote a series of adventure novels, which rather bizarrely he co-authored with his mum. And he was an explorer. He was sponsored by the Daily Express to go out to Patagonia to search for the giant sloth, which he didn't find because it wasn't there anymore, having become extinct. And after that, he was rated as one of the best shots in England, and in fact had a lot to do with reorganising sniping for the British forces in the First World War. So the man had an extraordinary life story. I mean, one of the things that interests me about it is that though he had to play as an amateur, because he was a gentleman, you see, and he couldn't be a professional, he had to earn his own living, which he did by writing, basically.
How did you come across him?
I'd come across him in a history of Hampshire cricket, you know, years ago. And when we raised this launched this series, I thought it'd be a good subject. I've made contact with his great-grandson, and there are family papers which I shall I'm hoping to get up and go and see.
And what happened to him after his cricket career?
He ended. Well, in fact, he contracted something during the First World War, died in, I think, 1922. He was still quite a young man.
What's the readership of this journal? What kind of people read this?
It's our members, and we've got about 1,200 members at the moment, of whom about 1,000 are in this country, and the other 200 spread across, really, the other cricketing parts of the world. Probably the average age is fairly high, I would think. And with statistics, you've now got attention, because really printed statistics, I think, are going to die out, because all the information is on the internet and it gets there extraordinarily quickly. You know, I was this week I had an email from somebody in India telling me that Jayawardena of Sri Lanka had become the first man to score 14 test 50s at the same ground. Now, that's pretty sort of detailed stuff, you know. But it'll all be on the internet, it'll be on one of the big cricket websites or something like that.
So what happened to the journal? Did those statistics?
Well, I mean, we will be more historical and less statistical, or presenting a sort of second generation statistics. You put the statistic in, but you give it some life, some background, really, some explanation.
Are you interested in getting a younger readership, reaching young?
I think we need to have a younger readership, or there won't be any of us left. We've had a bit of a membership drive, and certainly numbers are increasing at the moment, fairly slowly. But I think there will be younger people. I was dead keen on that sort of thing when I was 14, 15, you know, probably a slightly nerdy little boy.
What do you think is the appeal of cricket to young people nowadays?
I think that's a difficult question, because an awful lot of young people nowadays just don't know anything about it at all. Now, that's partly because it's not in the schools, partly because people are arguing it's not on free-to-air television anymore. But something I was looking at the other week is that in the years after the war, boys' comics, who were nearly all published by D.C. Thompson in Dundee, would run a cricket story during the summer regularly. I mean, a rather fantastical cricket story. I mean, the great Wilson once bowled Australia out twice in a day, taking all the wickets personally. I think that was in 1953. But, you know, at that point, it was accepted that working-class boys would be interested in cricket. You know, in the winter they'd run football stories, the summer they'd run cricket stories. Now, that and those particular sorts of comic, which were very heavily text-based, died out at about the same time. And I think also that the game has retreated slightly to become a sort of middle-class preserve in this country. There was a time when there was a considerable inflow from the Afro-Caribbean community. That's almost completely stopped, because football has taken over completely there. It's now really, I suppose, the South Asian community, Indians, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, and they're also spreading the game across the whole world. And I've been at a conference this week, and one of the people who was speaking is very interested in developing the game in the USA, which, strangely enough, was important in cricket in the middle of the 19th century. And there is an argument that, in fact, if it hadn't been for the American Civil War, the big cricket rivalry now would be England against the USA, not England against Australia. But it didn't happen like that. You know, because, as I say, the Civil War stopped tours going over there, and people went to Australia instead, because that was somewhere else where people were playing cricket.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I'm not sure, really. I just want to get up there and see what gives, you know, see what it's like.
Thank you very much.